Sam not only claimed to carry the DNA of Erica Van Sloan and Enlil, the last of the Anunnaki, but he had also restored Sloan's youth. In order to swing Lakesh to his side, Sam had accomplished the same miracle with him. Only much later did Lakesh realize the Imperator's restoration had been something less than miraculous. None of the Cerberus warriors found the concept of an entity bearing the blended genetic material of three races disturbing. However, the powers he appeared to wield and his autocratic attitude were frightening. Sam hadn't come right out and threatened the lives of those in Cerberus, but he hadn't needed to. The implication that he could do so if they turned down his offer certainly hadn't been subtle. On the face of it, what Sam offered was exceptionally tempting and even logical. Rather than have Lakesh and his Cerberus exiles continue to wage their uncoordinated guerrilla war on the Barrens, Sam wanted those resources under his control, where they would be given direction and focus. By allying with the Imperator, Lakesh and his people would be protected, and he would have a voice in the implementation of a new order. There would be no more need to hide, and the Cerberus exiles wouldn't bear the stigma of being outlanders any longer. Sam's proposal thus made perfect sense. Perhaps that was what made all of them so suspicious. And now, decades after the Imperator's first appearance, the new free culture he claimed he wanted to build was a reality. And it had the skids under it, sliding down a slippery slope to the lip of a precipice, overlooking the red mists of hell itself. In the political backwash of the Naroda conflict in Asia, and as the standard of living for the population at large dropped off, individual governments fell, and the combined military forces of the Imperator stepped in. Most of Europe and almost all of Asia came under a worldwide military dictatorship formed by Imperial forces. But the American Confederated States hadn't fared much better than the rest of the world. The economy was liable to collapse at any moment. The culture groaned under the weight of countless unskilled unemployables who had to be fed, clothed, and housed at the expense of the states. The corrupting influences of state-supplied squid implants kept the idle from rioting and committing crimes, true enough, but it also deadened them to truth and individual initiative, blinding them with a cloak of illusory beauty. No one knew or cared any longer about the difference between freedom and cushioned slavery. Behind the facade of well-being created by the squids, the culture seethed with indolence and ugliness. The squids also kept the population of old and new humans in check by numbing the drive to procreate. It was a cleaner way to exterminate the useless eaters than pogroms and mass executions, for the population would be slashed from millions to mere manageable thousands in less than a decade, and those thousands would be slaves adapted to meet various needs. The hybrids who now coexisted peacefully with humanity were at risk, even if they were the chosen ones of the Imperator. No matter that they were not completely human, they sprang from essentially the same roots as humankind, so they were still a continuation of the race. The world may not have been as violent and brutal as before, but it was far from being the utopia that Sam had described. It was a comfortable prison, but a prison nonetheless. Cain hated it, and that hatred didn't derive from a sense of dissatisfaction. He knew the world was trapped in a whirlpool of wrongness. He had contemplated the whirlpool for many, many years, since the apparent destruction of the Naroda movement. He had tried to decide whether the sense of wrongness was a strictly subjective impression brought about by emotional trauma, or was a true physical distortion of reality. Finally, he reached the conclusion that it was a combination of both. Grief and loss had helped him see the distortion. And now that the distortion had been observed and identified, it could be rectified. The plan Cain had worked out was both direct and clever, although he knew options should be left open for elements of improvisation.
It has to be done. Someone has to find a solution and call a halt to this insanity, right?
Yes, I know.
Sam is like a wizard, a sorcerer with his mind control techniques through those goddamn squids. He owns most people. He's accomplished in one generation what the Barrens tried to do for 90 years. Unifying the world under one whip, like a team of dogs. Someone has to save humanity, or what's left of it. We have to act for humankind. And even if we die in the attempt, at least the world will survive to judge us.
Grant said nothing. He stared at Cain across the table, not blinking, not moving, or even appearing to breathe. Kane felt some of the tension drain away from himself. He was right, and he knew Grant was sure of it. Then he saw a tiny glitter of moisture within Grant's deep-set eyes. It took him a few seconds to realize the man's eyes were glistening with tears. Grant lifted one hand in a gesture.
Tomei?
Kane caught only a blurred, fragmented glimpse of gleaming metal from behind him. Then the edge of the female guard's butterfly sword touched his throat, forcing his head back.
I'm sorry, Kane. Give me the memory cards without an argument, and I'll arrange for you to get back home safely. But I don't ever want to see you here again.
I wouldn't think you'd have me beheaded for trying to save lives, particularly Shizuka's.
The pressure of the sword blade against his throat increased, and he clenched his teeth, glancing up into the face of the guard. Her lips were compressed in a tight white line, and her dark eyes gleamed with fury. With a cold rush of recognition, he understood why her complexion was so dark.
I'm sorry, Tomei. I'd forgotten your name. You and your twin brother were only four the last time I saw you.
I never forgot you, Godfather. I remember the last time I saw you like it was an hour ago. You and Daddy brought my mother's body back here. She died saving your worthless ass.
For a moment, Tomei's figure faded and was replaced by a vision of an armored Shizuka standing in the courtyard of Scorpia Prime's stronghold. Monstrous, semi-human pishchakas came at her, and her swords carved them up. They died screaming beneath her whirling blades, voicing either cries of pain or pleas for mercy. When she finally fell under a massed assault, the surviving goblin men hooted and jumped up and down on her corpse, performing antics like a crowd watching a sporting event. They cheered when one of the pishchakas held aloft her disembodied head by its long hair.
Someone I loved more than anyone or anything in the world died that night, too.
Kane did his best to keep his voice from quavering with emotion. He didn't want the girl to think he was afraid of dying.
Hi. Your beautiful and brilliant wife who had come to negotiate your release from Scorpia Prime. Both she and my mother died for you. And what have you done to honor their sacrifice? Become an obsessive, delusional madman who does nothing but bring pain to those who once loved him.
Kane cast his eyes from Tomei to Grant.
Is that what you think I am? A madman?
Grant pressed the heels of his big hands against his forehead as if trying to keep his skull from breaking apart.
I don't want to talk about this anymore. I'm sick of it. Sick of you. Sick of your fucking fantasies. Even if you could get those data cards to work in whatever machine you and Bri have cobbled together, you're too goddamn crazy to trust with it. I wouldn't send you to the harbor to bring back a fish, much less send you back in time.
Kane swallowed a surge of sudden fury, and the up-and-down motion of his throat opened a small laceration. The almost weightless crystal cards now felt as heavy as bricks, hidden as they were in a slit pocket of the shadow suit.
I've spent years on this, Grant. Years. You understand? I've got it all reasoned out. I've traced the primary fault line back to the fracture. I can change things. None of what happened these past 27 years need happen. None of those people need die.
Grant dropped his hands from his head to the tabletop with a crash.
Turn over the cards, Kane.
No.
Tomei slid the blade of her sword under his chin and exerted pressure.
Do as my father, the Daimyo of New Edo, commands. Ikazuchi Kojima, Thunder Isle, is part of New Edo's sovereign territory. Therefore, you are no better than a common thief.
Kane stared directly into the girl's eyes.
You're going to have to kill me, kid.
Tomei positioned herself for a decapitating stroke.
Do you think I won't? I would love for you to suffer the same fate as my mother. It would truly be justice.
I loved your mother. More than that, I respected her and her devotion to Otoko no Michi, the ancient and honorable samurai tradition. She was a fierce warrior, but she wasn't an assassin. Do you think she'd approve of what you're doing now?
Kane recognized that sound. He had heard it issuing from Grant countless times over the past 40 years. He hoped it meant the same thing with Tomei as with her father. A noise of frustration when reason won out over angry impulse. Grant gestured impatiently.
That's enough, Tomei.
She glanced toward him, her eyes widening in surprise.
Daddy!
Do it.
The girl relaxed some of the tension in her sword arm, but the blade wasn't withdrawn.
He's a thief! You've executed men for just trespassing on Ikazuchi Gojima. You can't let him
Yes, I can. Do as I say, sweetheart.
Blinking back angry tears, Tomei whipped the butterfly sword away from Kane's throat, and with an eye-blurring swiftness, resheathed it. Kane gingerly touched the skin at the base of his jaw and examined his index finger with rueful eyes. A spot of blood shone damply against the black fabric.
I'm glad you're being reasonable.
Grant rose, slowly coming to his full height like a mountain pushing its way up from the surface of the sea. He extended his right hand toward Kane.
Let's see how reasonable you can be. The cards?
Kane locked eyes with Grant.
Are you getting deaf in your old age? I already said no.
If you don't turn them over, I'll take them from you. And I won't be gentle about it. You may end up wishing I'd let Tomei cut your throat.
Kane exhaled a long breath through his nostrils. Using the top rail of the balcony as a brace, he got to his feet.
Grant, you're going to have to try to take them from me.
Grant stared at him stolidly, expressionlessly, for a long, silent moment. Kane met his gaze, but he saw how pain creased his dark, scarred face. Bleakly, he realized he had known Grant for nearly half a century and still didn't fully understand him. Even the years they had spent together as magistrates and then fighting the barons hadn't made them much closer than the first day they had met. He knew why. Grant feared not having any control over events that determined the fates of others. Like Kane, he remembered how in every battle they entered, they lost people they had considered friends. Each death hurt far worse than a bullet glancing off their magistrate polycarbonate armor. Finally, out of a sense of self-preservation, Grant adopted a pragmatic philosophy. If you don't make friends, you can't lose friends. If you have nothing, you can't suffer losses. Grant had deliberately maintained a distance between him and Domi, so if either of them died, or simply went away, the vacuum wouldn't be so difficult to endure. Then he had met Shizuka and fallen deeply in love. Domi had died, never knowing how Grant really felt about her. And then Shizuka was ripped ruthlessly from Grant's life, and he was still struggling with the pain of her loss 20 years later. Kane well remembered his own helplessness and rage when Bridget had been torn from him on the same night Shizuka was killed. Like Grant, the hole her absence left was never filled, but unlike him, the pain it left in its wake strengthened him. He had silently vowed never to let anyone he cared about be taken away from him again, even if he had to warp the laws of science and nature to fulfill that oath.
Kane, the only reason you've never tried to rule an army or a vill of your own is because you never gave a shit about pushing people around. But if you have the power to change history, you could rule the damn world without giving a single order, and nobody would know it. That's too much power in the hands of anybody, including you. That's why I made Thunder Isle off-limits to the rest of the world. Even Sam is afraid to send people here. Now maybe you've got a foolproof plan.
I do.
But you'll never know if it works or not because it's too fucking dangerous to find out.
Grant bared his teeth in a snarl of frustration.
Give me those goddamn cards.
Kane shifted his weight on his heels, then to the balls of his feet, glancing over toward Tomei to make sure her blades were still sheathed.
No.
Grant blinked, lifted his massive arms as if in a shrug, then lunged forward, kicking the small table out of his way. He cannonballed into Kane, who whipped out his arms as if to embrace him. He locked his arms about Grant's body, trying to pinion him. Grant rammed the crown of his shaved skull savagely against Kane's forehead, and little multicolored spirals erupted behind his eyes. His grip loosened. Grant broke free of it, snarling and growling in bloodthirsty gratification.
Shizuka died for you!
Grant slapped both hands around Kane's neck and began to squeeze. Kane jabbed his thumbs into the sides of Grant's neck, seeking out the nerve centers. But all of Grant's tendons and muscles were tense with the fury of his intention to choke Kane into unconsciousness. Kane jabbed 3 fingers into the man's solar plexus. It was like jabbing a plate of flexible steel. Grant grunted in pain but held on. He applied his thumbs to the blood vessels on Kane's neck. Kane shoved himself away from the gallery, catapulting them both through the wall, taking lapwork and oiled paper squares with them in a loud, clattering crash. They kicked and tore their way through the wreckage as they grappled with each other on wide-braced legs. Tomei shouted shrill words at them, but the men paid her no attention. They lurched back to the gallery, and Tomei was forced to spring aside to avoid being bowled over. Grant forced Kane's upper body over the tough wooden rail. Although tempted, Kane didn't knee him in the groin. He used the heel of his hand to force Grant's head up and back. Grant removed his left hand from around Kane's neck and planted it against his face for further leverage. Kane sank his teeth into the base of the bigger man's thumb.
Son of a bitch! Cut it out!
You cut it out. You started it.
I'll finish it, too.
Grant tore his hand loose from Kane's mouth and stumbled backward, still clutching Kane by the throat. The two men staggered drunkenly from one end of the gallery to the other. Kane strained, kicked, and fought his way out of Grant's stranglehold. Grant stiff-armed Kane in the chest, slamming him back against the railed gallery. He flung himself at Kane again and seized his throat, squeezing it as if wringing out a towel. Kane didn't have the time to pry the big man's fingers from around his neck. Their combined weight was too much for the wooden railing. With a splintering crack, it gave way and both men plunged to the ground. The fall was barely 15 feet. Falling backward with Grant atop him, Kane doubled up his knees and planted his feet against the man's midsection. When he hit the turf on his back, he straightened his legs like steel springs. The soles of his boots pushed solidly against Grant's belly and propelled him up and over. Whoa! The man performed a clumsy mid-air somersault, arms windmilling wildly, the belled sleeves of his kimono flapping like the wings of a crazed bird. He slammed down full length on the ground, the top of his head barely 3 inches from the crown of Kane's head. Both men elbowed themselves over onto their knees, faces contorted in bare-toothed grimaces. Kane struck first, a swift left jab against the hinge of Grant's prominent jaw. Grant's immediate response was a looping right hook. For a long moment, the two men crouched on hands and knees, snarling into each other's faces as they exchanged a flurry of blows. Kane glanced up just as Tomei somersaulted completely over the broken rail of the gallery like a trained acrobat. She landed beside the two men and came up as though she had steel springs in her legs. Almost in the same motion, she crossed her arms over her waist and whipped her butterfly swords from their sheaths. She placed the flats of both blades against Grant's and Kane's chests.
Enough!
The two men glared at each other.
Stay out of this, sweetheart.
Yeah. This isn't any of your business.
What isn't my business? Watching two old men snap and slap and paw at each other like a couple of bear cubs instead of the trained killers both of you are? If either one of you really wanted to kill the other, one or both of you would already be dead.
Tomei removed the swords from their chests and stepped back.
If I'm wrong, I'll give you the chance to do it right.
She jammed the blades point first into the ground and released the hilts.
Have at it!
Grant and Kane stared at the lengths of mirror-bright steel. They shone with the reflected highlights of the setting sun. Kane nodded toward the sword closest to Grant.
Go ahead.
You first.
Both remained on their hands and knees, eyeing each other warily. Then Kane struggled to one knee.
Oh, shit. It's getting late. I should be getting home.
Grant slowly pushed himself up to his knees. Joints popped audibly, and he winced. Lips creased in a small smile, Tomei reached down and helped both men stagger to their feet. A squad of Tigers of Heaven jogged around the corner of the palace, armor and swords clanking. Tomei called to them, waving them away. They hesitated, then slowly withdrew. Kane turned his head and spit a little jet of blood that had flowed into his mouth from a cut inflicted on his tender cheek lining. Grant dabbed at the blood flowing from his right nostril with the sleeve of his kimono. Tomei touched his nose gently.
Is it broken?
That thing has been broken so many times, he wouldn't be able to tell.
Are you going to give me those memory cards?
Uh-uh.
Grant's brow creased, and his big hands knotted into fists.
They're all the hope I have, Grant. My only reason for living, for waking up every day. You have your daughter and your son, and new Ado to give you purpose.
He patted the left hip of his shadow suit.
This is it for me. This is all I've got. You can kill me to keep me from taking them, if that's the only option you've left yourself. I won't give a damn. I'd much rather be taken out by a friend than a stranger.
I want to believe. your motives are as unselfish as you claim.
All I want is to undo a terrible thing that was done to people who didn't deserve it. That's the simplest way to put my motives. If I eliminate the cause of the terrible thing in the past, then the nature of time will arrange to eliminate the terrible thing from the future.
You hope.
Kane nodded.
Despite all the calculations I've done, all the studies, all the computer simulations and scenarios I've run, that's really all it gets down to. Hope.
And if the Neroda have actually found an alternate means of temporal manipulation, then Kane may be the world's only chance after all.
Grant folded his heavy arms over his chest.
Isn't that a frightening thought?
Kane frowned at his old friend, trying again to identify the exact but minuscule philosophical difference that kept Grant from trusting and joining forces with him. He noticed the subtle change in his bearing at the mention of the Neroda. With a sense of shock, he understood it was a memory, not a difference of opinion, that maintained the wedge between them.
It's the Neroda, not me, that have you scared, isn't it?
Grant stared at him levelly, then shook his head.
It's not them so much as your connection to them, Kane. And Lakesh and Erica's connection, too. And now to hear that they sent Tanvira to you?
Grant's words trailed off when he saw the expression of incredulity on Kane's face.
What the hell are you talking about? I don't have a connection to the fucking Neroda. Neither do Lakesh and Erica.
I always think back to that night when Shizuka and Bridget died.
I was there, too.
You were, and you weren't.
Kane balled his fists and took a menacing step toward him.
What the hell do you mean? My back still hurts me in wet weather.
It's been over 20 years. I guess it's time to get this all out in the open. Let's go back inside and I'll tell you.
Kane felt his stomach turn a cold flip-flop.
Tell me what?
What I saw, and what you did, but apparently can't bring yourself to remember.
A gibbous moon seemed precariously balanced atop the spired minaret. It thrust up from the center of a huge mass, which in itself rose from a clearing in the Assam jungle. The red sandstone of the ancient walled temple, once a palace dating from the days of the Mughals, held a rusty hue like old bloodstains. The northernmost of the old Indian states, Assam was bracketed on the north and west by the Himalayas and Tibet, and by the brooding Naga hills on the southeast. The land itself was primarily swamps and jungle. The Brahmaputra River slashed through the forested vastness like a great knife. At one time, the region had been considered the premier spot to partake of the royal sport of tiger hunting. At least, that was what Lakesh had claimed. He also cited local legend that held when the great god Vishnu dismembered the body of Shiva's beloved consort Shakti, Shiva carried the parts away, but her yoni, her sexual organ, fell into the jungle. The fortress appropriated by the Neroda was built on that precise spot. There, Shakti worship flourished, which honored women and extolled them to the heavens, in theory at any rate. A Shakta scriptural text read, "Whosoever has seen the yoni of a woman, let him worship it as he would the feet of a teacher." All the backstory Lakesh provided flitted through Grant's mind, as he and Shizuka crouched in the shadows and eyed the Neroda fortress. It had been almost ridiculously easy to breach the security perimeter of Scorpia Prime's stronghold, even if the overland journey from the Goalpara River had been grueling. Grant, Shizuka, and a 10-man contingent of Tigers of Heaven avoided the armed guards easily, the steady booming of drums smothering the rustle of vegetation. Grant was the only one carrying firearms, a streamlined Steyr AUG auto rifle, and a pair of .45-caliber S&W Model 645 double-action handguns. A slender pulse plasma rifle, a so-called quartz cremator, was slung over his right shoulder. A dozen grenades were packed into a zippered war bag slung over his left shoulder. He had never been able to convince the samurai that guns were just as efficient as blades. The Neroda sentries carried their own firearms in a way that suggested little expertise or experience. As far as Grant could see, they were all men, and all of them wore simple uniforms consisting of sleeveless jerkins, shorts, and turbans. But they were bright red in color, Apparently, they had never seriously entertained the concept of camouflage. Their weapons were streamlined and skeletal, reminding Grant of the spidery SIG AMTs in use by Imperial forces. The faces under the turbans were painted red on the left side and dead white on the other. On the right cheek of each guard, starkly outlined in black, was the silhouette of a scorpion. Grant and Shizuka examined the building from the shelter of a half-tumbled-down wall. In the sickly lunar glow, they saw how the pillars were carved to represent every conceivable sexual joining of male and female, male and male, female and female. Lakesh's briefing jacket had footnoted the Naroda's worship of Shakti and the practice of tantric rites. Grant didn't quite understand the sect's devotion to the eternal principle of female sexuality, an aspect of the mother goddess Devi, the wife of Shiva. But he figured Shizuka did, and that was enough for him. Bidding the tigers to wait for them, Grant and Shizuka slunk into the palace grounds. Both of them were dressed in dark clothing, Grant in a black shadow suit and Shizuka in a partial suit of armor. Her milk and roses complexion was blackened by stripes of combat cosmetics, her long black hair bound up at the back of her head. They entered the fortress through a deserted courtyard full of shadows and overgrown shrubbery. Inside the palace, Grant and Shizuka followed the distant thumping of drums. The smell of mold and mildew was redolent enough even for Grant's thrice-broken nose to detect. The lack of guards didn't comfort either him or his wife. Instead, they were so suspicious and wary, they tended to overreact to any stimulus. The two people rounded a corner, and both of them bit back curses of revulsion at the scene that lay below them. From an inner balustrated gallery, they stared down at the vast central hall serving as the temple of Shakti. The area was illuminated by flaming braziers and lanterns that threw a shimmering veil of color over the naked celebrants. Torches sputtered at equidistant points around the chapel, the wooden columns thrust into buckets of sand. The glow of the torches was dimmed by shifting planes of hot, acrid smoke. There were at least 50 people scattered around the circular chamber, some lounging on low divans, others indulging themselves from the food on long banquet tables, cramming it into their faces. Many more sprawled on nests of cushions and pillows, their faces slack, their eyes glazed. The odor of the smoke was familiar. Grant recognized it as Cannabis lupus, known in the Outlands as the werewolf weed. Composed of a mutated form of marijuana and various other herbal narcotics like opium, the werewolf weed stimulated the hindbrain, causing an atavistic regression. It had been outlawed for many years in America because of its popularity. Its primary attraction was to allow the imbiber to wallow in artificial bestiality for a time. Some bands of roamers and marauders appreciated the weed's influence before a raid, since it made them fearless and even immune to pain. Grant realized that the blend of the weed grown in India was probably far more potent and addictive than that found in the Outlands. He caught glimpses of cudgel-wielding pishchakas lumbering about at the edge of the temple, apparently acting as sergeants-at-arms. He wasn't surprised by their presence, since one of the disadvantages of werewolf weed was that the user could turn on his friends as quickly as an enemy while under its influence. The fumes stung his eyes and coated his tongue with a foul, sulfurous tang. He breathed shallowly through his mouth, hoping the smoke wouldn't affect him. Sinuous serving girls slid among the celebrants, allowing themselves to be fondled, caressed, and groped. Their tawny, oiled bodies were naked except for jeweled bangles. Grant guessed there were an equal number of men and women in the temple, but as far as he could see, none of them were engaged in overt sexual activity. Their attention seemed focused on a small stage at one side of the hall. Grant followed their gaze and stiffened. He felt Shizuka tense up beside him. Cain hung spread-eagled between two of the obscenely carved pillars, his wrists lashed to iron rings sunk deep into the stone. He was naked, and his back was a raw, red ruin of slashed and sliced flesh. Blood trickled down the backs of his thighs to his ankles. His head hung limply between his shoulders, and Grant guessed him to be unconscious. From a brass-bowled brazier near the stage, a cloud of greenish-yellow cloying smoke poured, smelling far worse than the werewolf weed. The opiated stench filled the temple, collecting in a cloud beneath the domed ceiling. Shizuka inhaled a bit of it and nearly succumbed to a coughing fit. Grant felt dizzy for a moment and had to turn away, gulping for fresh air. When the vapor thinned, a tall female figure stood motionless before Cain on the stage. But the face wasn't human. It required a few seconds of squinting through the veils of sweet smoke and blinking his blurred eyes for Grant to realize the woman wore an elaborate helmet. It was apparently crafted out of burnished silver and fashioned to resemble the body of a great scorpion. The gleaming mandibles swept over the forehead and formed a mask over the woman's eyes. The foreclaws and pincers curved along the sides of her face, resembling the jaw guards of ancient Roman helmets. The stinger-tipped tail curved up over the ridged crown of the headpiece like a crest. From the crowd, a chant arose, a babble of confusing voices, but one word finally became identifiable.
Scorpia! 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 Scorpia!
Grant exchanged stunned glances with Shizuka. It hadn't occurred to him that Scorpia Prime might be a woman. With her features obscured, he couldn't see much of her face, but a graceful swan-like neck led to a voluptuous body draped in a thin, gauzy silk, which only blurred, not obscured, her long legs and firm, round breasts. Taut nipples pressed against the thin fabric, as if she were in a high state of sexual arousal. Her body was too perfect. She was like the idealized male image of feminine beauty, rather than a real living woman. For an instant, Grant wondered if a cunningly crafted mannequin had not been placed on the stage under the cover of the smoke. But then he saw Scorpia Prime gesture, and he knew she was definitely alive. In a loud, clear voice, Scorpia Prime began speaking.
The enemies of divine annihilation gather in the darkness. They would continue to ravage Earth by burning away the green from our jungles, turning flour to ash, clean water to poison.
The assembled horde howled in approval, but Grant sensed a curiously ritualized quality about their reaction, as if they had rehearsed it for many days prior to the ceremony.
Tonight, the forces of annihilation are drawn together. Tonight, we seal our pact to serve Shiva, to bring about the Pralaya, the destruction of the universe. As a scorpion stings itself to death in the hot sun, we shall see to it that humanity does the same. The moment of our triumph is upon us.
She gestured to Cain, sagging in his bonds between the pillars.
As we possess him, so do we possess the secret steps to the Tandava, the dance of destruction. He came here to destroy, to prevent us from fulfilling our pact with Shiva. So we will mingle this man's two life forces as a consecration of our pact. Tonight, Shakti strides among us.
Scorpia Prime began to dance around Cain, moving her hands and arms in ritualistic intertwining angles and arcs. Steel gleamed in both of her hands. Her thumbs were tipped with curving tips of metal like claws, or, Grant realized bleakly, the stingers of scorpions. He watched the woman, recalling Lakesh's description of the sacred dances of Shiva, the divine creator and destroyer who haunted graveyards as the Lord of Ghosts. Scorpia Prime danced the part of one of Shiva's wives, Kali, who feasted on sacrifices of human blood. At that point, the woman swept her right thumb down Cain's torso, the steel spur inflicting a crimson-welling incision from his chest to his pelvis. He didn't so much as jerk in response. Grant made a motion as if to shoulder his stire and start firing at the masked woman, but Shizuka laid a restraining hand on his arm and shook her head urgently. Her face, beneath the stripings of combat cosmetics, was very pale.
Cain is already in so much pain at this point, he can't feel much of anything.
Bleakly, Grant knew she spoke the truth. He couldn't help but wonder at the extent of his friend's numbness, whether he was either suffering from a drug-induced paralysis or simply faking unconsciousness. Grant could only watch as Scorpia Prime continued to dance around Cain with the consummate grace of an artist, yet with the abandon of a nymph. As Sati, another wife of Shiva, she mimed sacrificing herself to her lord by leaping into imaginary flames. It was the ritual act of Sati, the long-banned custom of Hindu widows joining their husbands in their funeral pyres. The masked woman then began Shakti's dance of divine lust to the pulsing beat of the drums. In slow motion, Scorpia Prime danced around Cain, embracing him, sliding her arms around him, smearing the blood from the cut she had inflicted all over his body. She assumed a variety of erotic postures to suggest intercourse. Although Cain's head didn't rise, his penis did. Scorpia Prime lowered herself to her knees before him. What followed was almost too sickening for Grant to watch. It was what Lakesh had vaguely referred to as Tantrika rites, the ingestion of the two fluids of life, and what Scorpia Prime had called Kane's two life forces. All during the act of raw carnality, Kane's eyes didn't so much as flicker, but shudders racked his frame. After a few moments, Scorpia Prime pulled away and majestically rose to her feet. She faced the crowd, the firelight glistening from reddish moisture on her lips, and raised both arms in an imperious gesture.
Avatara Shiva!
Incarnation of Shiva.
The announcement and her performance had its desired effect on the celebrants. The men and women clutched at each other wildly in a mad variety of sexual joinings. They cried out to Shakti to appear among them.
Shakti! 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 Shakti!
The crowd suddenly parted, and several of the red-turbaned Naroda soldiers dragged a woman into the center of the temple. They were laughing, echoing the chant of the celebrants.
Shakti! Shakti! Shakti!
They made it sound as if they were delivering a package. Grant craned his neck to get a better view of the captive who was being hauled forward. He groaned deep in his throat when he recognized Brigid Baptiste. She was humiliatingly dressed in little more than twists of silk around her breasts and loins. She looked like a prostitute one might find in the street bazaars of Calcutta. Her long, red-gold mane of hair hung loose, and it was twined with bright jungle flowers. They had powdered and rouged her cheeks, painted her lips a bright red. Beneath the harlot's mask they had daubed on her, Grant could read fear and anger in equal measure on her face. Her eyes glinted emerald hard, but they went wide with shock when she saw the spread-eagled and bloody cane. She struggled to no avail between the turbaned men who pinioned her arms and dragged her toward the stage. They hauled her up a short set of stone stairs and brought her face to face with Scorpia Prime, who eyed her haughtily. Grant could see Brigid's lips moving, but he couldn't hear what she said. He guessed the fate Scorpia Prime had in mind for her. She was to be the centerpiece of an orgy, while the helpless and drained Kane watched. Suddenly, Brigid kicked herself off the floor, using the cultists as braces. Her long legs flashed, and bare feet came up and connected solidly against the underside of the Scorpia Prime's jaw, lifting her up on her toes and sending her staggering back against one of the pillars to which Kane was lashed. The woman's scorpion helmet was dislodged and fell from her head, but she managed to catch it. The Naroda soldiers instantly tightened their brutal grips, forcing Brigid to her knees. Scorpia Prime held the mask with both hands for a moment, glaring over it in maddened fury before putting it back on. Brigid met that glare, and her delicate features twisted first in astonishment, then a rage that overwhelmed the same emotion imprinted on Scorpia Prime's face. Grant felt the reaction to the woman's unmasking like a 40-pound sledge. In the couple of seconds before the helmet went back on, he saw how the woman's complexion was the flawless hue of fine honey. Her long, straight hair, swept back from a high forehead and pronounced widow's peak, was caught up in a braid at the back of her head. It was so black as to be blue when the light caught it. The large, feline-slanted eyes above high, regal cheekbones looked almost the same color as her hair, but glints of violet swam in them. The mark of an aristocrat showed in her sculpted features, with the arch of brows and her thin-bridged nose. Grant was too numbed to shoulder his rifle, too stunned by the sight of the woman to move, speak, or even breathe. He had only seen her a few times in the past, but with a marrow-freezing sensation of horror, he recognized her immediately.
Erica? Erica Van Sloan?
Grant nodded only once.
Unless you know another Erica, yeah, that's who I mean.
The two men sat in a room on the far side of the palace from where they had dined. The room opened onto a balcony that overlooked a shoal of craggy rocks and a small bay. The chamber, which was on an upper floor of the fortress, served as Grant's office, study, and even his trophy room. Light gleamed on upright glass cases holding mementos of Grant's past. They were knives with old bloodstains on the steel blades, guns of different makes, his Sin-Eater and Copperhead from his years as a mag. Even Domi's knife, the one with the 9-inch-long, wickedly serrated blade that had cut Guana Teague's throat when the pit boss of Cobaltville was strangling the life from him, was on display. Reverently spotlighted in a tall display case were two suits of body armor mounted on metal frameworks. One was a suit of samurai armor, standing like a silent sentinel. Kane didn't need to be told the armor was Shizuka's. A ceramic jar, painted with a stylized tiger, rested on a small wooden pedestal at the bottom of the case. Kane knew that within the jar were Shizuka's cremated remains. Standing beside her samurai armor was the black, close-fitting exoskeleton of a hard-contact magistrate. Grant and Kane sat at a desk and dabbed at their injuries, mainly minor contusions and abrasions, with sponges soaked with water and a healing but strong-smelling unguent. Too stunned to speak for a moment, Kane stood and went to the balcony, propping his elbows against the top rail. He vacantly gazed out at the harbor. A number of quays and docks were built around a spit of volcanic rock that jutted into the blue waters. A cluster of vessels was tied up there, mainly barges and skiffs, but also a flotilla of larger vessels that had all the characteristics of warships. They were all of a type, riding high above the waterline, consisting of sharp angles, arches, and buttresses, with sails made of waxed and oiled paper. The port was a beehive of activity, with the fishing boats returning with their day's catch. Dusk was creeping up over the sheltered cover, and the orange ball of the sun had already lost its brilliance. Green nets hung from pilings and were spread out over the docks. People wearing a simple ensemble of cotton t-shirts and shorts swarmed all over the waterfront area, laughing and singing as they worked. It was a pretty scene, with a storybook quality. Even though Kane retained vivid recollections of repulsing an invasion force of mags dispatched from Baron Snakefish in those same waters, he remembered how, shortly after the battle, when the tide went out, the crescent moon of Sandy White Beach had been stained red at the waterline.
Kane?
I don't remember anything like that. All I recall is waking up right as Bridget...
He clamped his lips shut on the rest of his words, unable to put a voice to the memory. His thought processes moved sluggishly, like half-frozen mud, as he strained to dredge up even a fragmented recollection that corresponded to what Grant had just told him of that night. Grant stepped out on the balcony beside him.
You were drugged and in shock. Besides, even if you could remember, Erica's back was to you and Bridget unmasked her.
The blood pounded in Kane's temples, and he felt like smashing the flimsy door of paper and lathwork with his fists, but he decided he had caused enough damage to Grant's home for one visit.
Why didn't you tell me about this then, after we blew the munitions dump?
I was in a little bit of shock myself that night. I'd been shot, like what, about 3 times and stabbed twice? And I was positive I saw the Scorpia Prime being burned alive by one of the incend grenades you threw. One of my tigers found her body, but it was burned beyond recognition. That helmet was welded to her head. So when Erica turned up later, alive and without so much as a hank of hair smelling like smoke, I figured I'd made a mistake because of those damn werewolf weed fumes. I was a little out of it, even before all hell broke loose.
Kane took a deep, calming breath, trying to control the adrenaline-fueled spasms in his stomach muscles. His mind started to glue the bits and pieces of new information onto the old. With an almost suffocating sense of defeat, he realized that with only a minimal amount of turning and twisting, the pieces all fit together. Sam, the self-proclaimed imperator who wielded control over the prana, the old Sanskrit term that referred to the world soul, Lakish and Erica, who had sworn undying allegiance to Sam after he used the prana energy to not only restore but also maintain their youth, the squid implants, which supposedly connected all the New World citizens with the World Soul, and hence to Sam, and thus making them citizens of the adaptive Earth. The Naroda's sudden rise from obscurity to ultimate power in the Indian subcontinent, evolving almost overnight from a small sect of fanatics to a well-armed nation within a nation, because of their devotion to bringing about the time of Pralaya, the complete destruction of everything except for the World Soul. Bridget's death and Erica's plea that Kane become her consort, choosing Lakesh only after he rejected her. The rift that developed between him and Grant after the death of Shizuka, leaving her children without a mother, him without a wife, and a kingdom without a ruler. Kane's 2-decades-long obsession with understanding the work of Burr and other Operation Kronos scientists, and how it proceeded from the assumption that the nature of time was like an ever-rolling river, then learning from Erica how the very existence of time depended on the presence of space, and that if space could be measured, so could Kronon strings. The sudden appearance of Tanvira at Cerberus, coinciding with a critical juncture of his temporal manipulation researches, with a tale of how the Naroda had made similar discoveries, but intended to use them to bring about the time of Pralya. Tanvira's subtle urging that he go to Thunder Isle, and the Operation Kronos installation there, pretending that she knew nothing of the hard feelings between him and Grant. All the arrows pointed in one direction, and they pointed so blatantly, Kane wondered if he had been mentally incompetent for the past 20 years, or if he were now suffering from the paranoid delusion to end all delusions.
"We've been duped, Grant. Played for fools since the day Cerberus fell."
Grant stared at the bay and the boats bobbing on its surface without really seeing them.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, when Sam and Erica finally realized none of us in Cerberus were going to join them willingly in their war to overthrow the Barons, they decided not to give us much option. They deliberately allowed Baron Cobalt to return and take over again."
Grant frowned skeptically, then relaxed with dawning comprehension as the implications of Kane's words sank in.
"There was no way Cobalt could have secretly enlisted the backing of the other Barons and managed to grab the reins of power back from Erica without help from some quarter. We always knew that, and you always suspected Sam had something to do with it."
"That help might have been nothing more than Sam and Erica simply stepping aside and allowing Cobalt to complete his plans. Or Sam could have pretended to negotiate terms with Cobalt, knowing damn well the treacherous son of a bitch would crawfish on any promises he made and turn on him. In that case, Sam would have essentially financed his war of attrition."
"For the sake of argument, let's believe that's exactly what Sam and Erica did. Are you saying they manufactured the Naroda movement?"
"No. The movement itself was real enough. That checked out. They were just a small rag-ass sect of fanatics controlling an isolated part of Assam. We've seen it happen before."
Grant said nothing, knowing what he meant. Despite the global megacult 2 centuries previous, many concepts survived and even thrived in the new post-nuke environment. Rituals of sex and a taste for organized religion echoed in one form or another down through the years following the nuke cost.
"However, the Naroda received some kind of aid, drew on resources in order to expand their field of operations and sphere of influence and gain new recruits. The practice of tantric sex worship never died out completely in India. That's a powerful tool and inducement to join up."
"If Sam provided the aid, then there had to have been a payoff of some sort. What could it have been?"
Kane paused, eyes narrowed as he pondered the question.
"The most obvious objective would be to build a power base in Southeast Asia. Another reason would have been to keep the pot boiling, the shit stirred up."
"What?"
"After the formation of the CCS, we had only a couple of years of relative peace, right?"
"If that. There were roamer gangs trying to organize and divide up the outland territories, the Peshchaka revolts, and then the Naroda started their brush wars and exporting their terrorism. A pretty damn busy time. Not really peaceful."
"Maybe too damn busy."
"How so?"
"A society built on war and threats of war is usually too distracted to question itself."
Kane paced away from the balcony, crossed the room, and then returned to it. He didn't feel as agitated as he appeared, despite the topic of discussion. For the first time in many years, more years than he cared to remember, his point man sense was awake and alert again. During his mag days, because of his uncanny ability to sniff danger in the offing, he was always chosen to act as the advanced scout, as the point man. When he walked point, Kane felt electrically alive, sharply tuned to every nuance of his surroundings and what he was doing. He felt alive now, no longer out of sync with the flow or direction of his life. As he and Grant reasoned out a problem that a self-styled genius had concocted to stymie lesser intellects, it was a reminder of an aspect of his years battling the Barons he had keenly missed. If only Bridget had been there to round out the triumvirate, to bounce back ideas, possibilities, and counterproposals, then the world would be the way it was supposed to be. The three of them, the living incarnation of the Tremurti, contending again with unknowns, facing down a menace, diffusing a threat and outwitting death.
"A pattern is forming here."
Kane nodded in silent agreement. It was a pattern of such long-range, intricate, and complex evil it made his belly twist in knots.
27 years of undergoing wars, hardships, strife, loss, both of us growing very old, very fast, while Erica, Lakesh, and Sam retained their youth, and they stayed together while we were driven apart, separated. Everyone and everything that meant anything to either one of us was taken away, while they built the world they wanted, their adaptive Earth.
A world of survivors and victims, no different than the one we were born into.
Survivors survive in different ways. We did it by being tough, but not very conniving. So when being conniving became the prerequisite for surviving, we turned into victims.
I guess you're right. But that doesn't mean you can change things by tampering with the temporal flow.
Kane fastened a challenging gaze onto Grant's face.
Doesn't it? Think about it. Time and mind have a way of dealing with things that go wrong. Right at this second, just by discussing what we're discussing, you've joined me in the long process of undoing what has been done. That's the subjective element of quantum physics.
You've been living with Bri for too long.
Try to dissuade me from the conviction that domestic situation shouldn't be changed by any means necessary, and we'll be rolling around on the grass again.
Where are you going with this?
I think you know. Everything that has happened to us, to the world, from the moment Sam first appeared nearly 30 years ago, was staged. All the events were parts of a plan he, and for all we know, Balaam, developed. Maybe even before Sam made his public debut during the Baronial Council, after we destroyed the Argileta Mesa facility.
Grant stared at him with open disbelief.
That's stretching things a little, isn't it?
What were we taught about strategy back at the Mag Academy? It's all about multiple scenarios. When we raided a slag hole, we didn't have just one plan, we had 10. So look at all the evidence. If Lakesh had joined Sam when they first met, then more than likely Baron Cobalt would have never returned after the siege of his vill. Or if he had, he would have never been able to pull off the coup that he did. We wouldn't have had a consolidation war or a Piszczaka uprising, since there would have been no reason to breed them. And I doubt we would have had to contend with a Scorpia Prime. Brigid, Shizuka, Domi, and maybe everybody else we knew would probably still be dead. More than likely, so would we.
Grant knuckled his chin contemplatively.
Because we still would have refused to join the Imperator, even though he wanted to overthrow the Barons. Eventually, we would have ended up fighting him.
Exactly. Baron Cobalt and the others did Sam an enormous tactical favor by destroying Cerberus. That act left us no choice but to join him. That's a pretty fragile chain of coincidence to hang our perceptions of reality on, wouldn't you say?
I would. But what about Balaam? Lakesh claimed he saw him in Shan, but only once. If he was supporting Sam, mentoring and counseling him, where did he go?
Who the hell knows? Who cares? Sam claimed to have Enlil's genetic structure, and Balaam had Enlil's...
Just like all the other hybrids. It's not particularly significant.
Maybe not.
Kane fell silent. He remembered how Balaam was anchored to the hybrid barons through some hyperspatial filaments of their mind energy, akin to the hive mind of certain insect species. Inasmuch as all of the Archon genetic material in the hybrids had derived from Balaam, that connection wasn't particularly surprising. Lakesh had learned that the DNA of Balaam's folk was infinitely adaptable, malleable, its segments able to achieve a near seamless sequencing pattern with whatever biological material was spliced to it. In some ways, it acted like a virus, overwriting other genetic codes, picking and choosing the best human qualities to enhance. Their DNA could be tinkered with to create endless variations. It could be adjusted and fine-tuned. Even more shocking was Balaam's admission that he and his ancient folk were of hybridized human stock themselves. Not alien, but alienated.
Whether Balaam was really guiding and counseling Sam way back when isn't very important now.
What the hell is, then?
That we accept once and for all that everything that happened over the past 27 years was all part of a scheme to breed people like me and you out of existence. We're intelligent dinosaurs, but dinosaurs nevertheless. If we couldn't be controlled or exploited, then we had to be isolated, like zookeepers used to do with rogue animals. Our support systems were taken away from us. Our wives, our friends, our beliefs, and finally each other. In short, Sam, Erica, and Lakesh clipped our talons, pulled our fangs, and gelded us.
Speak for yourself.
We also have to accept that none of it was supposed to happen. It was an unnatural twisting of events, of forcing the flow of our lives into directions they weren't meant to go, a distortion of the timeline. And finally, we have to accept that we must take any chance, jump at any opportunity to make things right again.
Reaching into his pocket, Kane brought out the four memory cards, fanning them in his right hand. The setting sun struck dull glints from their crystalline corners. Grant regarded the little wafers with suspicious, narrowed eyes.
I can use these to make things right again. I can finally implement my own plan, working backward from now to make sure this now never is.
What?
It's risky. I won't deny that. I may trigger a transdimensional discontinuity, and all of us will be sucked into a temporal cross-rip with our heads in the Triassic Age and our asses stuck in the Renaissance. Or I'll bring into existence a branching probability universe, and nothing will change here, and none of us here will be the wiser. But
you might do nothing more than fuck up a few key events in the past so that our now is essentially the same as it is at this moment, only worse. Like, I never had children. I never met Chizuka, and I'm a blind cripple in the Outlands begging for food from dregs.
Kane opened his mouth to counter Grant's objection. Then he swallowed hard.
I understand. Who knows? Maybe I'm under the control of Sam. Maybe Erica injected those damn squids into me 20 years ago, and I've been doing the Imperator's bidding all along.
I get the point. We confuse ourselves out by counting up all the possibilities.
Yes, but that doesn't invalidate your fears.
Grant grinned lopsidedly, placing his hands flat on the top rail of the balcony.
It doesn't validate them either. All right, you can take the Dilator's memory cards, but you still haven't explained to me how you'll get around the double occupancy paradox. Neither me, you, nor Bri can go back to the time before the attack on Cerberus, since we all existed then.
His shoulders stiffened as a sudden notion occurred to him.
You're not planning to send Lakesh's kid, Tanvira, through, are you?
Kane smiled wryly.
Nice idea, but no. We'd still have a temporal paradox to try to get around. If I dispatch her back in time, and her actions keep our present from coming into being, then she won't have been born, and therefore she won't be here for me to send back.
Oh, do tell me more. This is so like having Lakesh visit, I'm about to cry with the nostalgia of it all.
Kane didn't blame him for being irritated. He remembered how sorry he used to be after asking such questions of Lakesh. They inevitably led to brain-battering concepts better left alone by minds steeped in the elementary ABCs of mathematics and physics.
So noted.
Kane folded his arms over his chest, clicking the little crystal wafers together in his hand.
To get back to your question of whom to dispatch, for the mission to have any chance of success, it requires someone who was completely out of the Chronon stream during all those key years. Someone who didn't contribute to the temporal fracture lines. Someone who can understand these particular principles of quantum physics in order to initiate the proper sequence of events to change things. Someone who knows us. Someone who has a vested interest in this kind of world not coming into existence.
As Kane spoke, Grant's forehead acquired deep creases of consternation and confusion.
Someone who was completely out of the Chronon stream? That would have to be someone who wasn't even born, right?
Kane shook his head.
Not necessarily.
It can't be someone who died before all of this happened, can it? Does that mean you're planning to trawl somebody we know from the past, like Sindri did to Domi?
Grant broke off when he saw the almost imperceptible change come over Kane's studious expression. He stared at him silently, wonderingly, mind wheeling with conjecture and wild speculations. A chill hand caressed the base of his spine. His own face contorted in a mask of appalled incredulity. Pushing himself away from the balcony, Grant took 2 stumbling steps back, nearly colliding with a display case.
Now wait just a damn minute.
The breeze was light and not particularly cold, even at such a high altitude. It caught Tanvira's hair and blew it in a delicate tracery over her face, even as it pressed the thin fabric of her robe against the contours of her body. A half-moon splashed the plateau with an ectoplasmic radiance, small gleams reflecting from the scattering of old metal. Some of it was so corroded it was impossible to tell its true shape, while other bits were as shiny as if they were freshly minted. She found herself not quite as distressed as she thought she would be after her communication with Sam, but then she hadn't been able to tell him about Kane's apparent disappearance from the redoubt. She had only discovered he was missing an hour ago, and Bri refused to supply any information about where he had gone. During the telepathic exchange with the Imperator, Tanvira had expected to be chastised by her half-brother for having so little to tell him. But she wasn't surprised when Sam only inquired as to the disposition of Kane and the status of the mission. He was disappointed in her lack of hard intelligence, however.
I am willing to be questioned. Do you wish a summation of events?
Unnecessary. I see what transpired in your mind. So you have not learned anything of value from him?
Tanvira winced when the Uma Stone transmitted the acidic texture of accusation into her mind.
Nothing specific. I am still trying to gain his trust.
She supplied the image of treating Kane's wound in the shower, accentuating the proximity of his naked body to her own.
I see.
The vision of Sam's face in her mind seemed to smile, coldly and mockingly. Behind the smile, Tanvira sensed a dreadful hunger, an equally strong distrust for what it needed to control. Human life, human aspirations, human dreams. The Imperator would not have admitted to distrust, however. He referred to his objective to control humanity as the Great Plan. She had been a part of it since the day, the very hour, of her birth. She considered it a great honor. In many ways, her relationship and interaction with Sam was similar to the manner in which the trust of the old baronial system was organized, which in and of itself was the last in a long line of secret societies that held and concealed the knowledge of the Archon Directorate from the world. Such societies traced their roots back to ancient Egypt, Babylon, Mesopotamia, Greece, and even Sumeria. Throughout mankind's history, secret covenants with the entities known as Archons, by kings, princes, and even presidents, were struck. It was probably the only workable tradition from the Barons Sam had retained.
A subtle seduction is taking too long to resolve the problem. I perceive a more direct approach might be necessary.
Into her mind swelled an image of her thighs gripping Kane, of her hands stroking his sweat-filmed back.
I understand.
Good.
Tanvira understood that ambition, even the emotionless aspirations of an Imperator, had to accept the limitations of reality. It took time to control the wild, mad human beings who infested the planet. It had required decades before the dominion of the Imperator could be firmly established on one continent, much less on four. The planet was so vast, and even after several wars, people were so plentiful, the task seemed too great to ever be accomplished. And there were still people scattered throughout the Outlands who refused to become part of the Imperial Society, and therefore had not been subjected to the squid implants. There were not a great number of them any longer, nor was it quite the same stigma to be an Outlander as it had been a generation earlier. In baronial days, a person's classification as an Outlander was in some ways worse than a death sentence. It was a form of non-existence. For people who had been born outside the direct influence of the Vils, who worked the farms, toiled in the fields, or simply roamed from place to place, being an Outlander wasn't a punishment. It was simply the way things were. They knew they were reviled by the Vilbred. To be recognized as a person with a right to exist, one had to belong to Vil society, even if only in the lowest caste. Those who weren't chosen to belong, or chose not to, were the Outlanders. They were expendable, the free labor force, the cannon fodder, the convenient enemies of order, the useless eaters. Brigid Baptiste, Grant, Kane, and all of the exiles in Cerberus were reclassified as Outlanders. Although the advent of the Imperator had changed the old caste system, those who didn't submit willingly to his authority were threats to the Great Plan. The sheer enormity of the Great Plan was enough to intimidate anyone. But Sam's ideals governed his life and those closest to him. To dominate everyone, control every destructive urge, to eliminate waste, to unify, to establish the law of pitiless logic and cold reason wherever humanity could be found. The only way the species could survive was by domination. However, the neuronic energy provided by the squids, channeled through the heart of the world, did not allow the Imperator to read or directly control minds. It did, however, permit him to give and receive impressions, ideas, and visualizations. From these various stimuli, Sam possessed the ability to extrapolate from a handful of known facts and to predict the logical sequence of events. It was truly a talent, not necessarily a learned skill. To gauge and evaluate, and to reach a conclusion that was so probable as to be almost certain, was more than precognition. Tanvira had often secretly suspected the Imperator was accessing a computer program of some sort. He had blended technology to augment his own natural psionic abilities. Certainly, Sam employed molecular technology to maintain his health. The ill, the old, and the injured all suffered from misarranged patterns of molecules, whether damaged by invading viruses, passing time, or genetics. Sam's nanotechnology rearranged cells at a molecular level and set what was wrong aright.
Cain is the only failure I inherited from the reign of the Barons. All of them, particularly Baron Cobalt, tried but failed to control him or destroy him.